Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. Demonstrations in Spain as Catalonia's continue their push for independence after last week's vote for independence. Thousands of protesters gathered at rallies in Barcelona, Madrid, and other Spanish cities. In Madrid, the Spanish national capital, there also was a competing demonstration for Spanish unity. That demonstration centered on Madrid's plaza, featuring thousands of people waving red and yellow Spanish flags. The prime minister says he will not rule out using constitutional powers to take away Catalonia's autonomous status if the region does in fact declare independence. The chief of Iran's powerful Revolutionary Guard is warning regional U.S. military bases in the Mideast would be a risk of an Iranian missile attack if Washington imposes new sanctions against Tehran. U.S. President Donald Trump plans to declare in the coming days that Iran is not in compliance with the 2015 International Agreement to Curb Its Nuclear Weapons Agreement, but then give Congress 60 days to decide whether to renew economic sanctions against Tehran. The Iranian state media quotes Guards Commander Mohammad Ali Jafari as warning Sunday if new sanctions are imposed, the United States would have to move their regional bases outside the 2,000-kilometer range of Iran's missiles. Tropical storm Nate continues pushing inland over Mississippi and Alabama Sunday with maximum sustained winds of 110 kilometers per hour, according to the National Weather Hurricane Center, where the forecasters say rapid weakening is expected. The storm made landfall twice, when it was a hurricane early Sunday near Biloxi, Mississippi, and Saturday near the mouth of the Mississippi River. This is VOA News. Explosions at a natural gas station in Accra rocked the Ghanaian capital on Saturday, causing a massive fire that forced residents to leave. There was no word on casualties, although Reuters news agency cites a deputy information officer as saying some people had been killed and quite a number injured. He did not have specific casualty numbers. Iraqi Parliament Speaker Salim al-Jabari has met with Kurdish President Masoud Barzani 2 weeks after Kurds in Iraq voted in a symbolic referendum for independence. Citing a statement from Barzani's office, Kurdistan Democratic Party-affiliated network reported that the two leaders spoke Sunday of the need to protect security and stability, avoiding further tension between the two governments. The 24th referendum, or September 24th referendum for Kurdish independence from Iraq, deemed illegal by Baghdad, passed with an approval nearly 93% and a voter turnout of 72%. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence visited Las Vegas to express solidarity with the residents and visitors shaken by last Sunday's mass shooting at an outdoor concert, which left 58 people dead and nearly 500 wounded.
In America, we mourn with those who mourn. We grieve with those who grieve. And I stand before you today on behalf of my family and every family in America to say we are with you. Today, we are all Vegas strong.
London police have ruled out terrorism as the motive behind a car incident that injured a number of pedestrians near the city's Natural History Museum. Police said earlier that they were keeping an open mind about the incident after initially saying the accident was not being treated as an act of terrorism. Britain is now on its second highest security alert level after 5 deadly terror attacks this year, some involving vehicles. A Russian lawmaker who just returned from Pyongyang says North Korea is preparing to test a long-range missile. And Bangladesh's prime minister says her government will continue to support nearly 1 million Rohingya Muslims who have fled neighboring Myanmar to escape violence. In a challenge to President Vladimir Putin on his 65th birthday, protesters rallied across Russia, heeding opposition leader Alexei Navalny's call to pressure authorities into letting him enter the presidential race. Police allowed demonstrators in Moscow to rally near the Kremlin in an apparent desire to avoid marring Putin's birthday with a crackdown. A bigger rally in St. Petersburg, Putin's hometown, was disbanded by police after protesters blocked traffic and attempted to break through police cordons. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
And all the target groups, including the government, they feel that there were no justification for this long time of avoiding these actions against Sudan people.
The United States lifts sanctions on Sudan.
When it went to the government, there was no money in the treasury because of Cashgate, that massive looting of government resources. The donors left.
The Malawian president says his policies are jump-starting the economy to improve the lives of citizens.
I've always insisted that Mugabe will have a big problem trying to get rid of Emmerson Mnangagwa. And I think he has created a very soft landing approach.
And the Zimbabwean president Robert Mugabe plans to change his cabinet this week. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The United States announced it will lift sanctions on Sudan, saying the East African nation is addressing concerns about terrorism as well as human rights abuses against civilians in the Darfur region. The announcement came after the Trump administration removed Sudan from the list of countries whose citizens are subject to travel restrictions. The decision, however, leaves other sanctions in place, including those against individuals with arrest warrants related to atrocities committed during the conflict in Darfur. For reaction, I reached Dr. Rabi Adlai Teobaed, a leading member of the Sudanese ruling National Congress Party, or NCP, in the capital Khartoum.
This announcement of the United States of America lifting sanctions that continued for more than two decades against Sudan, not only the government, but all the people of Sudan, whether in the capital Khartoum or in the rural areas, all of them very happy and cheerful for that lifting of sanctions, and all of the people and all the target groups, including the government, they feel that there were no justification for these sanctions for this long time of avoiding these sanctions against Sudan people. And I think that lifting of sanctions will open the way and pave the way for Sudan government and Sudan people to receive investors and to receive financial assistance, and also to rehabilitate that institution destructed because of the sanctions opposed against Sudan for more than 20 years.
Moving forward, what do you see as the relations between Khartoum and Washington?
I think that Sudan will witness a new phase of relationship with the United States of America. And I think that this also will pave the way for normalizing the ties and the development of the mutual interest, especially investment of United States of America business in Sudan in different sectors, especially the sector of petrol and the sector of industry and the sector of agriculture. And this also will not only normalize the relationship between Sudan and the United States of America, and also will normalize ties between Sudan and other countries that, following the policies and strategies of the United States of America, including that countries in the Arab world and in Africa. I think that we cannot count the benefits of this lifting of sanctions against Sudan, but I think that the benefit and the impact of lifting of sanctions on Sudan people and Sudan government, this impact will be uncountable in different aspects.
Let's talk about possible economic impact on Sudan and investors and other countries working in Sudan. What impact will this reprieve have on Sudan?
Yes, I think that, lifting of sanctions will facilitate, for Sudan government to attract investors, as Sudan is enjoying a lot of resources, and also Sudan is being considered as a path to the food, not for the Arab or African world, but also for the whole world. Therefore, I think now Sudan government is to prepare, you know, the proper and suitable legislation and facilities for investors to come and to invest in Sudan. And I think also lifting of sanctions will facilitate the way for the concerned and specialized people in economics, in economy and planning to negotiate all the issues, financial issues with the monetary funds, whether the International Monetary Fund or the World Bank or other institutions that, you know, financing the big projects. And I think also this will be the way also to, you know, to discuss the problem of the debt of Sudan, either, you know, to facilitate the payment of this debt for a period, a long period, or to exempt Sudan from some of these debts. I think a lot of, you know, economical, you know, facilities which will be reflected from this announcement of 15,000 sanctions that opposed against Sudan for this long time.
Dr. Rabi Abdullahi Tiobaed is a leading member of the Sudanese ruling National Congress Party, or NCP. He spoke with me from Khartoum. Malawi has made a U-turn onto the road to recovery after 3 years of drought, floods, poor crops, budget deficits, and running the country without donor budgetary support. The Malawian president, Arthur Peter Mutharika, says this year the economy could grow by 5%, nearly double the 2.7% growth recorded last year. During a recent interview, President Mutharika told me he has looked to reform his government, reduce waste, focused on rural growth, making sure the agricultural sector has the resources it needs to grow, including roads, schools, and hospitals.
When going to the government, there was no money in the treasury because of cash gate, that massive looting of government resources. The donors left. The donors were providing 40% of the recurrent budget. So that was a real challenge, and I think that was affected. But now the economy is beginning to grow. You probably have seen that when I took over the country, inflation was 24.6%. Now, as of last month, it's 9.3%. Single digit, the first time since December 2010. That's right, single digit inflation. The interest rates were about 40-something percent. Now down to about 24, which is so high, but much better than it has been in Malawi for the last 5 or 10 years. So the economy is beginning to pick up. My advisors tell me that last year the growth rate was 2.7. They think we should have more than 5%.
So with the stringent spending cut that you put in, how effective has it been, and what would you say has been the success story of it?
I think it's been very effective. Cut back, and they try to invest in growth areas like agriculture and others, of course, education, social areas too, infrastructure, and foreign investment. So a combination of other things. We embarked on a program of attracting foreign investment. God knows I've been everywhere. I've been to China, I've been to UK, Brussels, wherever. Where anybody could listen to me, I've been there trying to attract foreign investment, in addition to have investment forums in Malawi itself. And it has paid off. A number of companies are now coming in, both from the East and also from the West, from Japan, China, India, but also from the West, from the United Kingdom, investing in different sectors, investing in the energy sector, health, education, agriculture, infrastructure, all across the board. Doing quite well. We want more. We're trying to create an environment which continues to be attractive to foreign investors. So it's a combination of all those things, I think.
And you know, usually these investors look at the governance of the country.
Indeed.
Yeah, they look at the political stability in the country before they come in.
Right.
What would you say has been the selling point of Malawi in terms of good governance?
Very good question. First of all, as you know, Malawi is very peaceful. It's one of the most peaceful countries anywhere in the world. On the peace index, I think that Malawi is number 5. And that's very important because investors, when they go to a country, they look for 2 things. They want security, or they want markets. Now, in terms of security, I've assured investors, 2 types of security. They want physical security, their families, and so forth. And assure them that their kids will go to good schools. And we have very good schools in Malawi, as you know, carved from the colonial system. So I've assured investors that if they come to Malawi, they'll be protected at home, at work, and in between. So that I can guarantee, because crime rate has gone down this past year by 5%. And then they also look for investment security in the sense of their commercial security, that their property will not be nationalized or unfairly taxed, and so forth. And Malawi is a party to a number of international conventions on the protection of foreign investment, but also it's also, well, local laws and a very, very viable judicial system that will enable an investor, if there's a dispute, to go to court and receive fair treatment.
Mr. President, in your initial submission, you talked about the looting of public funds.
Yes.
Let's look at the fight against corruption.
Yeah.
Where is it now at the moment? How is the fight against corruption?
Yeah.
No, I think the fight is a tough fight. I've said that there's corruption everywhere. But I think the fight can be won. Now, we've done a number of things. First of all, to sensitize people. You see, there are 2 aspects of fighting corruption, preventive and then prosecutorial. First, preventive, make sure that in almost every organization there's an integrity committee that censors people about corruption. And that's very, very important.
Some of your critics are saying that, oh, the president is using the fight against corruption to go after his opponent. How do you respond to that?
I think that's completely wrong. You see, the reason why they're saying that is very simple. That Castgate, most of the cases in the Castgate took place under the government of People's Party government. A combination of politicians, civil servants, and the business people during that regime. So that's why the investigations are. So it's obvious that the people were actually being investigated, both by the ACB and the DPP, Director of Public Prosecutions, are people from the People's Party. That's when Castro took place. So it's a political thing. You see, the trouble is that people want you to fight corruption, but at the same time, they don't want anybody to be indicted. But you cannot fight corruption without arresting somebody.
Arthur Peter Mutharika is the Malawian president. He spoke with me from New York. Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe says that he may make changes to his cabinet this week. His remark comes at a time of rising tensions within his ruling ZANU-PF party over who his successor will be. Mugabe told a meeting of the ruling ZANU-PF youth wing in the capital Harare Saturday that it was time to review the performance of his cabinet ministers. For analysis on the president's possible cabinet reshuffle, I reached to Rejoice Ngwenya in Harare.
Naturally, Zimbabweans are reacting with a high degree of trepidation, skepticism, and suspicion, because I've always insisted that Mugabe will have a big problem trying to get rid of Emmerson Mnangagwa. And I think he has created a very soft landing approach to try and sustain the pressure of how to deal with Mnangagwa. And Zimbabweans are saying it's terribly unfair to find a way of dealing with an adversary and involving our government in a very expensive venture. There's a lot of anger, in this part of the world there, Peter.
Rejoice, so you think this proposed announcement of changes to his cabinet is solely about Emmerson Mnangagwa, the vice president?
Look, I mean, we are just under 12 months or even less before election. And there's probably a catch to this, you know. First of all, he knows that the cabinet that he has been having since 2013 has totally failed to deliver. So he might actually be finding a way of not just dealing with his adversaries, but also trying to find a way of bringing into government colleagues that might be taking up resources to sustain the ZANU-PF campaign. So this is a very devious dictator. This man is experienced in manipulating a public and political system. So it might just be more than just trying to deal with Mnangagwa.
Some people are suggesting in Zimbabwe that this could be an expensive venture and that it is too close to the elections for this cabinet changes to be made. But he is the president. They all serve to please him, basically.
Absolutely. You know, changing a cabinet a few months before the election is totally valueless and expensive. You know, the stationery, the motor vehicles, you know, these present ministers are going to go with all their three high-end, you know, expensive vehicles, you know, the change of permanent secretaries, the shift of furniture. This is an incredibly expensive exercise. And I believe that opposition parties really should take this up with the Constitution, because it's an exercise that the current our country cannot afford.
Some are suggesting that the opposition parties should seek legal redress to prevent President Mugabe from undertaking this exercise of cabinet reshuffle. But they all serve at his pleasure. The Constitution gives him the mandate. Legally, how can they succeed?
Absolutely. You know, it is very difficult to approach the Constitutional Court to try and nullify an existing constitutional provision. But here, I mean, the legal team should really approach this from a sense, from a position of common sense and good old rationale, that a cabinet is going to come, there's a new cabinet that's going to be coming in after the election. So why even bother extending the shallow pace of the Treasury? So while it is constitutional within its right to reshuffle the government, but I think if you approach this case from a position of good old rationale, common sense, and really it's something that I think our Constitution also allows, if we feel that you know, as citizens, we are grieved by a decision of the executive.
Rejoice Ngwenya is a Zimbabwean political analyst. He spoke with me from Harare. The UN Human Rights Office denounces the killings of demonstrators from Cameroon's Anglophone community in towns across the Northwest and Southwest regions Sunday, October 1st, and is calling for an impartial investigation into these events. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Government figures put the number of deaths at about 10, but other estimates report many more people than that were killed. UN Human Rights spokesman Rupert Colville says credible sources indicate some of the deaths were caused by the excessive use of force by the security forces.
We call on the government of Cameroon to establish prompt, effective, and independent investigations to ensure accountability and, of course, impartial as well. Cameroon's Anglophone regions have seen multiple strikes and demonstrations over the past year as resentment and tensions have built at what English speakers view as discrimination against them in favor of the majority French-speaking population.
Anglophones make up about 20% of Cameroon's majority Francophone population. Grievances over their perceived economic and political marginalization have been building for years. The killings last Sunday came amid wide-scale protests by the English-speaking community, leading to a symbolic declaration of independence from the majority of the French-speaking country. The UN Human Rights Office is calling for restraint by the security forces to prevent a recurrence of similar bloody events. Colville says people must be allowed to exercise their right to peaceful assembly and freedom of expression.
We call on all people to pursue peaceful means to make themselves heard. Over the past few months, public and private property has been damaged, and at least two homemade bombs are reported to have been planted in public places. There have also been arson attacks on a number of schools.
Colville says his office welcomes comments by President Paul Biya in the aftermath of the killings, condemning all forms of violence and calling for dialogue to find a durable solution. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Meanwhile, UN aid agencies are struggling to meet the needs of refugees in eastern Cameroon as multitudes flee the renewed violence in neighboring Central African Republic. The population of the Gado refugee camp has exploded from just 1,000 refugees in January to 25,000 today. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kenzeka files on his trip to Gado with the UN.
Scores of children are being attended to by medical staff at the Gado refugee camp on Cameroon's eastern border with the CAR. At least 100 children fleeing with their parents have been received by humanitarian workers this week. 22-year-old Magloire Zema, who arrived at Gado last week, says she is happy her six-month-old son has recovered his health. She says he was neither eating nor had access to clean drinkable water, but today the situation is better because he can drink milk and eat a bit of their traditional meals. Health worker Jermaine Dizia says Magloire is lucky her son has recovered. He says many children who arrive at Gado die from hunger, malnutrition, or wounds inflicted on them by fighters while they are escaping from CAR.
C'est un problème majeur de santé publique et touche à grande partie les réfugiés.
He says malnutrition and hunger are becoming public health problems for children from Central African Republic arriving in the camp. He says many of them under the age of 5 end up dying. He says when the children are brought to them at the early stages of malnourishment, they are treated for 3 or 4 days and then are referred to their community workers for psychological and health follow-up care. Religious and ethnic unrest erupted in CAR after Muslim Seleka rebels seized power in the majority Christian country in 2013 and left the nation divided. 3 years of violence has killed thousands and led more than 300,000 to run for safety in neighboring Cameroon. Allegra Bauchi, resident coordinator of the UN system in Cameroon, says despite the increasing number of refugees and shortage of humanitarian assistance, many refugees have continued to flee to Cameroon as the crisis escalates.
We heard stories of insufferable violence, people who had lost their children, their husbands, their parents on their way here. Their first message was, please give us something to do. Please allow us to become more self-reliant and independent. But unfortunately, there was just not enough funding. Our response is underfunded. Overall, the humanitarian response in Cameroon is 40% funded. When it comes to refugees, that figure goes down to 20%. There's not much we can do with 20% of our funding.
Najat Rushdie, the humanitarian coordinator of the United Nations Office for Humanitarian Affairs in CAR, says she is launching an appeal to humanitarian agencies, the international community, and persons of goodwill to help the suffering multitudes in CAR and neighboring countries.
Les besoins sont chiffrés à 498 millions de dollars, alors que l'année dernière, en novembre,
she says this year, the needs of the refugees have increased to $498 million. She says the refugees have come to Cameroon to meet donor agencies who relocated because of the carnage. The United Nations raised less than half of the money it asked for in its last appeal, yet the number of CAR refugees and internally displaced persons has increased from 2.2 million at the beginning of this year to 2.4 million currently. Last week, Cameroon reported it had sealed its border with CAR after violence had escalated. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Gado, Eastern Cameroon.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Now, it's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin with the World Cup qualifiers for Russia 2018. Nigeria beat a stubborn Zambia 1-0 to become the first African side to qualify for next year's World Cup in Russia. The win put them on an ASEAN level, 13 points at the top of Group B. Nigeria stayed top in Group B and advanced with one game spare from a pool that was dubbed the Group of Death and expected to go down the wire. Russia will be Nigeria's sixth appearance at the World Cup. They reached the second round in 1994, 1998 and 2014, but got knocked out the tournament in the group stage in 2002 and 2010. In the other group game, Cameroon beat Algeria 2-0 at home, with goals from Clinton Injie and Frank Pangop. Reigning African champions Cameroon and Algeria, who got to the second round of the last World Cup finals in Brazil, have already been eliminated after disappointing campaigns. And in Kampala, Uganda and Ghana played to a goalless draw to hand Egypt an all-clear 2018 World Cup qualification. Egypt will host Congo on Sunday, but the result in Kampala means a victory over the Red Devils will see Egypt qualify for their first World Cup since 1990. The goalless draw virtually ends Ghana's hopes of reaching Russia, although Uganda will hope that Congo-Brazzaville can defeat Egypt on Sunday to keep their own hopes alive. Meanwhile, the Black Stars have lodged a protest with FIFA over refereeing decisions during the Kampala match. Ghana had a goal from Raphael Dwamena ruled out for offside in stoppage time. According to the Ghana Football Association, Ghana was denied a perfect goal in the 93rd minute, with television replays showing that it was a perfect goal. The referee also denied Ghana a penalty earlier in the second half when Ghana midfielder Frank Ashampong was brought down in the box. Elsewhere, Youssef Maskani's hat-trick helped Tunisia move closer to Russia with a 4-1 away win in Guinea, as the DR Congo kept their faint hopes alive with a 2-1 win over Libya. The final fixtures in the group will pit Tunisia against Libya and DR Congo against Guinea on November 6th. In Casablanca, Khalid Boutaib hit a hat-trick as Morocco beat Gabon 3-0 to leapfrog Ivory Coast at the top of Group C. Morocco now have a slender 1-point lead over Ivory Coast, and both countries will fight for the sole group ticket on the final day in Casablanca on November 6th. On Friday night, Ivory Coast drew 0-0 away to Mali in Bamako, which briefly put them top of the standings. Gabon are now eliminated from the race to Russia. And South Africa kept their World Cup qualifying hopes alive with a 3-1 home win against Burkina Faso, as Senegal went top of Group D with a 2-0 victory in Cape Verde. And finally, in athletics, American Galen Rupp erupted in the final 3 miles to win the 40th Bank of America Chicago Marathon on Sunday in 2 hours, 9 minutes and 20 seconds. He broke free of a 3-man pack that included defending champion Kenyan Abel Kirui and Ethiopian Sisae Lema sprint the win. Galen Rupp is the first American to win the Chicago Marathon since 2002. Teruneshe Dibaba of Ethiopia was the women's winner. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. Sana la la kuma funia ningatamani ningalikuwa na wenzo matania.
Safari, safari, zambali Visana mambo mengi Vina teso na jua ila mpenzi usijali Na sumu ya mapenzi Vina tesa moyo mchana kusiku silali Sukari ya mapenzi Isha ganda moyo ni zaidi ya tamu ya sali Tazamu zuri wako, penzi langu Sije shusha thamani Thamani ya penzi lako Ntaritunza moyo ni na kesho peponi Tazamu zuri wako Penzi langu usijinishusha thamani Thamani ya penzi lako Ntalilinda moyoni na kesho peponi Dunia na mapenzi Vina teso na jua sema mpenzi Tafadhali usiku silali Ulelela Sauko tayari Nikupeleke nyumbani Japo sina pesa manyumba gani Usijali Nauliza uko tayari Nikupeleke nyumbani Japo sina pesa manyumba gani Usijali Ona, yupo nilompenda Kwa utenzi na nyimbo na zezi nilimwimbia Akanati akaenda Na maradha kupenda moyo nikaugulia Yupo nilompenda Kwa utenzi na nyimbo na zezi nilimwimbia Akanati akaenda Na maradha kupenda moyo nikaugulia Maskini penzi langu Sina pesa mari na gali za kuringishia Chonde chonde roho yangu Nasimanza mapenzi moyo nisijekulia Maskini penzi langu Sina pesa gali na mali za kuringishia Chonde chonde roho yangu Nasimanza mapenzi moyo nisijekulia Dunia na mapenzi Vina teso na juwa sema mpenzi Tafadhali Omivo ya mapenzi Yana tesa moyo mchana usiku silali Za uko tayari Nikupeleke nyumbani Japo sina pesa manyumba gani Usijali Nauliza uko tayari Nikupeleke nyumbani Japo sina pesa manyumba gani Usijali Johnny
TMK for life. winning team, Kaleri winner, killing the beats to America, chilling with your homie, go Tanzania.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. There was a remarkable development in the troubling relationship between the United States and Sudan, two countries that have been loggerheads for over 20 years, spanning three administrations, the Clinton, the Bush, and the Obama administrations. But in the dying days of the Obama administration, President Obama proposed that sanctions against Sudan should be suspended and reviewed later. The review was to be taken by the new Trump administration. But at the time when the Trump administration was trying to undo sanctions lifted by the Obama administration in Iran and Cuba and imposing new ones in Venezuela, there was expectation that the Trump administration would not lift the sanctions against the Sudan. But last Friday, the State Department announced that a host of sanctions imposed on Sudan over the years will be lifted. The question being asked is, why now? There have been several suggestions. The New York Times, in announcing the lifting of these sanctions, suggested that because President Trump and his Secretary of State like Tillerson, have little interest in Africa. They have left lower-level officials in the State Department to work out these changes. Another suggestion has been made that those working in the security sections of the United States have been pleased with the cooperation they have enjoyed with Sudan in their counterterrorism strategy. Another explanation is that Israel and Saudi Arabia have intervened with President Trump to get the sanctions lifted against the Sudan. And yet another explanation is that the Trump administration has been able to convince Sudan to mellow its relationship with North Korea. So this is a situation which has not pleased everybody. Those in the humanitarian field are wondering why the change when nothing much has happened in Darfur, which was one of the problems that the United States and the West had with the Sudan. Secondly, they said they have seen no evidence that the government of Sudan has stopped meddling in the Republic of South Sudan. But the question we have to look at now is whether this change of policy of the U.S. and Sudan will be able to expand. And here we have yet another good news for the Sudan. In this very same week, last week, when these sanctions were being lifted, the German magazine Der Spiegel published a devastating critique of the first chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, ICC, Mr. Luis Moreno Ocampo. And that one showed that he had been collaborating with the major powers in the pursuit of their own foreign policy, and that during his 9 years in the ICC, he was not as independent as he had claimed. And since he was the one who issued the first warrant for the arrest of President Bashir of Sudan, this has also lessened the pressure on President Sudan. And we have noticed that there are very few called today for the arrest of President Sudan. And finally, President Trump, in issuing his new travel ban, Sudan was the only country that was removed from the original list. We are now asking the question, is this new rapprochement between the United States, will it last? I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Tiang Wang, we say thanks for joining us. I remember, as the elders say, old men sit in the shade because they planted a tree many years before. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On September 21st, Samoa deposited its instrument of accession to the Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention with the United States. In other words, it agreed to be legally bound by the terms of this treaty. Samoa's accession brings total membership in the Biological Weapons Convention to 179 states parties. International efforts to restrict bioweapons go back a long way. The Geneva Protocol of 1925 prohibits the use, but not possession or development, of chemical and biological weapons. In 1975, 22 governments, including the United States and the Soviet Union, signed the Biological Weapons Convention, a treaty meant to supplement the Geneva Protocol. The new treaty forbids its parties from developing or retaining biological weapons and related equipment, and obligates them to destroy or divert to peaceful purposes any weapons and related equipment they may already have, and to take measures to prevent the development and retention of such items. The latter is particularly valuable in reducing threats from non-state actors. Not every country is a member of the Biological Weapons Convention. Nonetheless, no state claims that biological weapons are a legitimate instrument of state power. General agreement exists globally that no disease should ever be used as a means of warfare. That's because bioweapons are indiscriminate, are difficult to control, and cause terrible suffering. While today's genome editing technologies are enabling advances in medicine and biotechnology, they also have the potential to make biological weapons easier to produce and harder to detect and treat. Imagine the damage that could result from the release in a densely populated area of a lethal bacterium that is immune to antibiotics, or a long-lived virus that is capable of traveling long distances in the air. The Biological Weapons Convention is critical to international efforts to address the threat posed by biological weapons, whether in the hands of state or non-state actors. Maximizing its effectiveness requires that all states become parties and fully implement its obligations. The United States strongly urges all states not party to the Biological Weapons Convention to join the convention without delay.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.